everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, podcasting to you from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today, as part of our ongoing series here, looking at new religious movements, I'm delighted to be speaking to Gordon Neufeld, author of Heartbreak and Rage, 10 Years Under Sun Myung Moon, a cult survivor's memoir. Gordon Neufeld is a freelance writer currently living in Alplaus, New York. He is a master's graduate of the University of British Columbia in creative writing. And in addition to his main book, Heartbreak and Rage, he's also published numerous book reviews and articles about his experience of once having been deeply involved in the so-called Unification Church of Sun Myung Moon. Indeed, he spent a decade in that organization and rose through the ranks to the position of leader in training at the Unification Theological Seminary. And it is to discuss that religion and its charismatic founder, Sun Myung Moon, and Gordon's own journey of coming out of the Moonies that we are joined by him today. So, Gordon, thank you very much indeed for joining us. It's good to be speaking with you after such a long time arranging this interview.
Okay, yes, and I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you very much for asking.
Now, I was delighted when you agreed to come on the program, because I also think it's a really good idea when you're talking about these kinds of things to speak to somebody who, if you can, to somebody who was actually involved in the organization that you're talking about, because, you know, it's one thing to speak to an expert who's learned about it all through books and the like, but it's quite another thing to talk to somebody who's actually experienced it firsthand, what it's like to get involved and live that life, and then, as you did, undergo the struggle to break free from that. So, as I say, I'm very pleased that you've been able to join us. Now, I'd like to ask you about your experience with the Moonies, but I really do think that an exploration of that experience will only make sense if we have some kind of idea as to what the so-called Unification Church is and what it believes. So, could I ask you, first of all, to tell us something about the history of that organization? You know, who was Sun Myung Moon and how did he come to set up this organization?
All right. I can mostly only tell you the things that I myself was told, which means that it may not always be true, but it's what they told me happened. Reverend Moon was born, well, actually, he was born in North Korea, what is now North Korea, before there was a division of the Koreas. And he was born in a large family. It couldn't tell you which son he was, but he was well down the line. But anyway, that family was originally Buddhist, but they converted to Presbyterian Christianity. And allegedly, Reverend Moon claims that when he was about 16 years old, it was 1936, and it was Easter Sunday, he was praying, because his family was now Christian, and he was praying, and he claims that Jesus, no, the story is confusing to me now, but I believe he said that God appeared to him, and God said that he needed Moon to fulfill the role that Jesus could not finish when Jesus was on earth. And it was like he was saying, my son Jesus had to die and therefore could not finish his mission. I need you to finish what he could not do. And Sun Myung Moon had to, or felt he had to, accept this commission, if you like, from God. And that is supposedly how it started. And then allegedly, again, because I have my suspicions about the veracity of most of this, but allegedly he then spent the next, say, 10, 15 years of his life in deep prayer. Allegedly, he cried so much that the tears soaked through the floor onto the next floor down, and all these sort of stories go around. But he was trying to understand more deeply the Bible and the stories of the Bible, some of which seem obscure and why are they in there at all, that sort of thing. And he eventually evolved what is now called the Divine Principle. The Divine Principle is the statement of Reverend Moon's doctrines. And in the Divine Principle, there's, well, a whole elaboration of things. Moon himself did not write everything in there. He had an assistant named Mr. Yu, who apparently wrote quite a bit of the Divine Principle, but it was all supposedly at Moon's direction. Now, Moon was in North Korea at the time of the division of the Koreas, and he was placed in a prisoner camp by the North Koreans because he was teaching doctrines and they were communists, and so they were supposedly against it. And the Unification Church has a whole lengthy story about how he heroically endured such terrible conditions at this prisoner camp until United Nations forces during the Korean War swept up that way and liberated the prisoners. And Moon then joined a kind of a general exodus of Koreans to South Korea. You know, they had to all flee because the battle lines were going and war was raging and all that. So Moon went to Busan, which is on the south coast of Korea. And in 1954, he founded what is now called the Unification Church. The full name of that church is the Holy Spirit Association for the Unification of World Christianity. So you understand the ambition of this organization, as it was originally conceived, is to bring all Christians together under one roof, if you like, one spiritual roof, with Reverend Moon as the leader. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that Moon had found out these hidden truths that would allow all Christians to say, oh, that's what this was all about, and all come together and back him.
So it was definitely a restorationist movement.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, what I wanted to ask you about the divine principle writing that is generally accepted as scripture within that organization. From what you said, it gave the impression that this was all through his reading of the Bible and prayer that this was developed. But is it true that he was also influenced by messianic prophecies within Korean culture itself? Because I came across the mention of some prophecies called the Chung Kam Nok. Did they play a role in the doctrine as well?
I don't know about those specific prophecies, but in general, yes, the Korean culture is steeped in this kind of thing, so that there are quite a few lesser well-known messiahs and messianic figures in Korea. I would say that Moon had to have been strongly influenced by it and perhaps set out to take advantage of it. You might argue that.
Mm-hmm. And then the influence and the connections the Moonies seem to have. They own the Washington Times, I believe.
Yes, they do.
And I understand that Sun Myung-moon went to tremendous lengths to sort of ingratiate himself with the political right in the U.S. And is it right that Moon had dealings with the South Korean CIA?
I believe they did. It would be more in the early stages than the later. And it would have to do with the very foundation of the church, I suspect, may have been in part funded or perhaps encouraged by the KCIA. Certainly when I was a member in the early years of my membership, Reverend Moon's translator was a certain man named Colonel Bo-hee Pak. He was a colonel of the Korean Army, spoke American English very fluently, and he would translate Reverend Moon's speeches. Reverend Moon would usually speak in Korean or sometimes Japanese. Now he's called Dr. Pak, but back then we knew him as Colonel Pak, and Colonel Pak was in fact connected to the KCIA. And it's a question, you know, who was the manipulator, who was using whom, because Moon may have been using the KCIA to get funding perhaps, or political support so that he could come to America and do what he wanted. I think the KCIA's objective was, this was back in the 70s, there was some talk of pulling out the American troops from Korea, and there was a great deal of apprehension in South Korea that the North would invade again. So the goal of the KCIA was to keep the Americans firmly on side with South Korea and not to back off and sort of try to play equals with the North or whatever. And Moon's role from the KCIA standpoint was to influence politically the United States so that it would remain more conservative and more inclined to commit troops and whatever other backing needed to protect South Korea from the North. Now, Moon's objective in turn would have been to use them whatever way he could so that he himself could be, you know, magnified, glorified, and just pursue his own objectives.
Is it right that Moon also had some spirit contacts when he came to the US with the occultist Arthur Ford, and that this guy was in touch with a spirit called Fletcher or something like that, and that this spirit encouraged Moon to believe in that he was the Messiah. Is there some truth to these stories?
Well, I once saw a copy of a book by Ford in which there is a chapter talking about the sitting with Sun Myung-moon. And allegedly what I was told was that this book was later suppressed or issued in a new version that omits this this segment. But one of the church members had a copy of the original version, and it, in it, Fletcher, the spirit, allegedly says, "Here is a man in whom there is no wrong," or words to that effect, implying that Fletcher was seeing Moon as sort of like, in effect, a messianic figure, and telling Ford the same. Now, of course, I don't know what to make of that at all, because my own experience is that the Moon is, if he was ever a man of great wisdom, he more or less lost it along the way.
So it could well have been that he approached Ford, and Ford had some idea of what was in Moon's mind and thought, well, I'll make sure that Fletcher confirms the kind of thing you want to hear.
That could be, yes.
And that, of course, happened in the U.S. So could you tell us then how Moon made that transition to go over to the U.S.?
Yes, he set his sights on the U.S. fairly early, but he didn't make the formal move to the U.S. till 1970 or 71. But he made a big trip through the United States by car in 1965, and he made a point of stopping in nearly every of the contiguous states, and allegedly set up what is called a holy ground, a place for prayer for members. It's sort of a consecrated area, often on public lands. And he went and sought out public figures that he could sort of influence. And usually, having never heard of him, they'd be congenial toward him. They'd think he's a Korean evangelist, and nice to meet you, sir, and so on. Even Dwight Eisenhower apparently met Moon during this tour of 1965. And then he returned in 1970 or 71 and began living in the United States. By that time, he had two or three groups that were kind of separate from each other, but they were like missions in the United States. One was on the West Coast in San Francisco Bay Area, and there was one in Washington, D.C., and another one, I'm not sure if I remember exactly, but he came to sort of unite these disparate groups and get the movement going in the United States in a stronger way. He pulled them all together, and he began what he sometimes called the One World Crusade. That was one of their slogans. The movement actually did begin to take off by 1972, and it started to become it's kind of notorious in the American press, but that was at a time when the radical left, which had been sort of at its peak in around 1969, or was dwindling, and young people were sort of looking around for other choices. And that's when the Hare Krishna movement got going well, and that's when quite a few of the Children of God, there were several groups like that, and the Unification Church was one of them, although the Unification Church was sort of different because the members were expected to dress conservatively, shave off their beards and mustaches, cut their hair short, and they were sort of quite a contrast to the ones chanting in orange saffron robes and so on. Yeah. So the movement got really going, I would say, then in America. And the peak of that would be, say, 1976. Moon gave a rally at the Washington Monument. He gave a speech. He had fireworks. He had bands. And it was all part of his campaign to see. I joined the Unification Church in 1976. So although I wasn't at that rally and didn't even know it was happening when it was going on, apparently, you know, it was all part of his thinking that I'm going to capture America. And we actually began to believe that within a few years, all of the United States would sort of agree, oh, yes, Moon has definitely got all the answers and we're all going to follow him. And then he reasoned that if he could capture America, then the world would follow suit and everyone would sooner or later be under his tent. So that was his plan.
Do you think that he really believed that the churches in particular would accept him as the second coming of Christ?
see, and this is another part of the Unification Church mythology, is that when Moon first began teaching in the early 50s, supposedly there were three leaders of Korean Christianity that he met with who were supposed to acknowledge him as the Messiah. And according to Unification Church mythology, if they had all accepted him, then their churches in turn would have accepted him, and then the movement would have spread around the world within a matter of a few years. But because they said, no, your doctrines are false and you're not right, supposedly, according to how I thought of it as a member of the church, that means they failed. They failed God. They failed to their calling. And the Unification Church has a whole doctrine about John the Baptist alleging that he failed Jesus Christ in the same way. So they are saying these people didn't jump to attention and say, yes, Mr. Moon, you are the answer. And so he would have come to America thinking, well, I don't think that Billy Graham is going to proclaim me Messiah either. I'm just going to have to convert individual people instead. But he actually did instill in us this belief that it could happen that way, a mass movement that within a few years would sweep the whole nation.
And so there must have been a tremendous growth then in the number of Moonies in the 1970s and presumably into the 1980s. When do you think their greatest period of growth was?
They would be in that period of the late 70s and 80s. But we have to keep it in perspective. Even though they were very visible and very noisy and so on, they weren't that massive in numbers. And the Unification Church has always had its largest following in Japan, ironically. And also most of the money to fund the church operations has come from Japan traditionally. In the United States, they maybe achieved 5,000, 6,000 members at their peak. And then it sort of leveled off. And in the 1980s, it really didn't grow much. And it has never grown since.
And do they acknowledge that?
I think they've grudgingly conceded it now. It's too apparent to be otherwise. Of course, now a whole generation has gone by, and the ones who joined when I did have been married in Moon's church and have their own children, and many of these children are members and many are not. So they've managed to maintain their modest numbers. But no, I think they admit it if you press them on it. Mm-hmm.
Now, I'd like to ask you also about the kinds of things that they believe, although we've touched on some of those things already, but in a little bit more detail. Now, it claims to be, as you've already said, a Christian faith, indeed to be the answer to Christianity, bringing all faiths together. And this is reflected in its title, which you mentioned, the Holy Spirit Association for the Unification of World Christianity. But really, it's quite different, isn't it? I mean, it's this main scripture, the divine principle, as I said before, seems to be a mixture of various ideas, Christian ideas, Eastern ideas. I detect Taoism in there. Some people say Confucianism is involved, and Spiritism, as we've also mentioned. So could I ask you a little bit more detail about their theology? And I'd like to start with their doctrine of God. So who, or I suppose I'll have to say what, who or what is God in Moony thinking?
I'd say that God himself, the Trinity doesn't figure exactly in Unificationism, but I have to qualify that. But they see God as much like a Christian would see God, is the ultimate, you know, father figure, heavenly father, is how we usually address God in the Unification Church. So
they would think then of God as personal.
Yes, and he's, you know, all-powerful, omnipotent, omniscient, and all the rest of it. What changes is this idea of who Jesus was, the person of Jesus. That's the big difference between Christianity and Unificationism.
Well, I certainly want to ask you about their view of Jesus, but just concentrating on this God question, I've read that there's the idea of the yin and yang, obviously from Taoism, also plays into their view of God, that God is a sort of collection of the opposites, the male and female, and that in their thinking is a fundamental reality about God,
yes.
And that therefore makes the Trinity impossible.
No, they just explain the Trinity differently. The idea is that God has both male and female aspects. Traditionally, you say God himself, but in unification thinking, God cannot actually be characterized as a him or a her. He's both, right? And then God divides into a male and a female aspect, and that is why there is an Adam and an Eve. And then when we come to the Trinity as traditionally viewed by Christianity, the Holy Spirit is considered to be the female aspect of God. Then the Jesus would be the masculine aspect, the Son of God. And so this is how they kind of see the Trinity.
What I find interesting about this is that from a Christian perspective, I mean, I say God is Father, and I tend to say He, but my understanding of that is that God is neither male nor female. This is just a convenient way of speaking about God in personal terms, you know. But you're saying that they actually do see God as a real duality of male and female principles here.
Yes, that is part of their doctrine. It's true.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so turning to Jesus then, is it right that, first of all, Jesus is not God in unification thinking? Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. Jesus is a person in unification teachings, a human being.
He is a human being who in himself embodies the masculine side of God. Is that right?
He's a perfected human being, allegedly, without sin. But yes, the unification teaching is that he was born the way other human beings are born, and they have a whole explanation for the conception of Jesus and so on. But that is the idea, yes.
So he's a perfect human being who came from God, and he came to establish, this is his mission, he came to establish God's kingdom on earth.
Correct.
But this is the difference here that I want to explore with you. It's not through dying on the cross and saving people from their sins, not just that anyway, I'll have to ask you about that, but primarily through having a perfect marriage and perfect children.
Yes, according to unification doctrine, that's what he was supposed to do. But because there was not enough faith in the world and no one really was following him faithfully, he had to take the way of the cross as a secondary alternative path to the one that he was supposed to achieve. So he didn't marry, he didn't have perfect children, and he didn't get it done. That's why God had to wait 2,000 years and try again.
And so when he went to the cross, I don't know whether it would be a mistake. Would you consider it to have been a mistake in unification thinking?
Not exactly, because in unification thinking, it was what he had to do, and it's not a mistake, but it was like a poor compensation for what was really hoped for. They felt that spiritual salvation is all very well, but what we need is physical salvation. We need to have the kingdom of heaven down here on earth and not just wait for it for when we die. So it's not a mistake, but the argument is that, you know, if Jesus was supposed to die, then why didn't God just send him to some tribe where they'd get rid of him right away and get it over with? Why did they send him to the Jews, and why did he have to have his mission and so on? So the argument is that he was actually supposed to convert the nation of Israel, and that Rome was supposed to follow, and then if Rome followed, the world would follow. That was their thinking.
Mm-hmm. But he nevertheless did get crucified, and he effected through that, again, this is according to unification thinking, he did effect through that some kind of spiritual salvation. Could you explain how that works? Is that fundamentally different to normal Christian thinking there?
It's not really different. It's just that they underrate it, whereas Christianity sees it as, you know, that's the great gift that God has given us. Unificationism sees it as, oh, well, we have to settle for that until we get a better deal later when the third, you know, the final Messiah comes. So but in terms of the actual understanding of the salvation and how it works, it is really online with at least some threads of Christianity.
Yeah, this is very interesting, because it seems to me that what's happened is that the normal Christian salvation story has been sort of split into two, because my understanding of Christianity is, you know, Jesus dies on the cross and he saves us, and we are spiritually saved, but we're also saved fully. We're also physically saved, except that physical aspect has to wait until God restores all things at the end of the age. And it seems to me that what Moon has done here is to sort of drive a wedge between the two things and say, well, Jesus deals with the spiritual bit, But he doesn't deal with the other bit. That I've got to do that bit.
Yes.
Right. Okay, that's very interesting that he managed to do that. And I suspect that fed into some ignorance in the churches where for many, many years people have not talked about the end of the age and the new heavens and the new earth. So I think that was ripe for people like Moon to exploit. Another question I need to ask here about this is, did Jesus actually resurrect from the dead in their thinking?
Yes, they believe in that part, yes.
So did he physically resurrect it from the dead, or is this still a spiritual thing?
What I was told when I was a Unification Church member was that God doesn't normally violate physical laws. So they would have argued, I guess, that when he resurrected, he was in some kind of spiritual body that had the ability to appear to be a physical body, but it was not. That he was appearing to his disciples in the spirit, but as you know, Thomas touches the side of Jesus and so on, so it feels like it's physically there, but it's really a more, if you like, an illusion.
Okay. Now, I think in order really to understand their take on Jesus more fully, I think I really do need to ask you about what I called the serpent seed doctrines before we started the interview. I said that I was going to call it that. And this gives us some of the reasons behind Jesus's mission according to unification theology. So could you explain how this works? Because this is a particularly idiosyncratic reading of Genesis chapter 3, which is normally called the fall of mankind. Could you explain how unification theology looks at this?
Yes, that's a very important part of church doctrine. The idea is that the serpent in the story is actually the archangel Lucifer. And God sent the archangel Lucifer, who was supposedly the most beautiful and wise of all the angels, to be Adam and Eve's sort of mentor. And Lucifer fell in love with Eve, and therefore, according to their Unification Church doctrine, he left his proper position as a servant of God and decided that he would possess Eve. So Lucifer actually seduced Eve, according to this. And when she went along with it and apparently, you know, did what people do, then she realized her error and she said, oh, I was meant to be the wife of Adam, not Lucifer. So then Eve went to Adam and in turn seduced him so that she could in a sort of make right what she did wrong. So in unification thinking, there were two falls. There was the fall with Lucifer, which is the original temptation in the Bible. And then there's the second fall where she goes to Adam and gives him the apple, which is actually a symbol of the sexual union. And that is the second fall, the fall of all mankind.
Okay, so let's be absolutely clear about this. So we have Lucifer actually having physical sexual relations with Eve in this story here.
Yes.
And that was forbidden.
Yes.
And then she has physical sexual relations with Adam thereafter. And because she's sinned in this first place, that's where the stain upon human nature comes from. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Now, I read somewhere that it's believed within the Unification Church that if Eve had not done this, if she'd resisted until she'd come of age, about 21, then she and Adam would have had perfect children. And as a consequence of that, the kingdom of God would have existed on earth. There would have been no death, no disease, etc. Is that right?
Yes, that's the belief. Everything would have been perfect from the start, and that's what God wanted, according to church doctrine.
Okay. So now, when we look at Jesus then, Jesus came to do what Adam, the first Adam, failed to do. So in their thinking then, Jesus came to have a perfect family, to do what Adam and Eve didn't do.
Yes, that's correct.
So he should have married, he should have had this perfect wife. I've heard it said that he should really have taken Mary Magdalene as a wife. Now, is that something that you were taught?
Not always, but I can see members arguing that. Nobody ever explicitly said whom Jesus was supposed to marry, but some would say that, yeah, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. And so had he found this perfect woman, I'm not quite sure how he would have found a perfect woman, but considering everybody in the human race is presumably stained with this original transgression, but had that been possible, then they would have had perfect children and that would have restored the kingdom. Does that mean then that the whole world would have been populated by Jesus's children and that's how the the kingdom would have been restored?
No, it would have been more along the model of Reverend Moon himself, who had 14 children by Hak Ja-Han. The idea would be that he would be the example, and everybody else would follow his example and take his advice and so on. And uh-huh. His family would be perfect indeed, but everyone else, according, you know, Moon's doctrine is that everybody else can become perfect as long as you obey him and you get his blessing through the holy wine. And there's a whole story about that. But anyway, there you are.
Uh-huh. So it would have been Jesus doing that. He would have been the one blessing the marriages in the way that Moon has been doing in recent years.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, so I thought that seems quite a clear view then that that's what should have happened. But as you say, Jesus was crucified. The plan B unfortunately took place, and it created this possibility of spiritual salvation. But now God says, well, now, Sun Myung-Moon, I need you to come along and to complete what unfortunately Jesus didn't manage to do. And I want you to now have a perfect family. And I understand that in 1960, when Reverend Moon married Hak Ja-Han, is that the correct pronunciation? Hak Ja-Han?
That's approximately right. I'm not sure how a Korean would say it.
Okay. So when they married in 1960, that Moon said that this was in fact the marriage of the Lamb, as Christians would say, looking at the book of Revelation. This was the marriage of the Lamb, and that therefore he and his wife had become the Lord of the Second Advent, therefore become the Messiah, the true parents of mankind. And so now they were in a position to effect what Jesus had failed to do 2,000 years before. Is that, have I characterized that correctly?
You've got it all correct, as far as I understand.
So is it that Moon was saying he was the Messiah, or that he and his wife together somehow were the Messiah?
That's an astute point, because really the doctrine says that they're both the Messiah, and that Moon goes on to state that church members are, in effect, messiahs to their own families and so on. He expands the term that way. And it's always this idea that you have to be a pair. You can't be successful if you're just by yourself. You need to be they call them blessed couples in the Unification Church. That's the married couple. And the married couple is, in effect, like a joint messiah, if you like.
And the idea here, this is the Taoist idea, is it, of the male and the female, therefore representing the perfect union of the opposite principles within God himself?
Yes, that's roughly right, yes.
Okay, yes, I'm obviously an outsider on this, so I'm trying to piece it together from the things that I've read here. So we have then the true parents bringing this full salvation, and this happens is this through the blessing ceremonies, the blessing of the marriages?
Yes, that's supposed to fix everything.
Okay, and this is the mass weddings that we've seen taking place have had so much publicity. Could you say something about what happens at these mass weddings?
Let me tell you just briefly about what happened when I was in one. So I had been a member for, 4 years when Reverend Moon matched me up to an English woman. I'm a Canadian, but I was living in the United States at the time. And I was a member of the Unification Church in the U.S. And we met in the ballroom of the New Yorker Hotel when Moon pointed first to her, and then he pointed to me. And then, in effect, we were given a chance to say yes or no to the match. I saw no reason to say no to it, so we went ahead with it. Then about a year and a half later, Moon called us to New York again for the actual wedding ceremony. So sometimes Moon does the matching part soon before the wedding part, and sometimes it's divided by, you know, a period of time. In my case, it was about a year and a half between the matching part and the actual wedding. So the wedding, or blessing as we called it, took place in Madison Square Garden on July 1st, 1982. There were 2,075 couples. And we walked into the doors of the Madison Square Garden arena, where, you know, there are hockey games and boxing matches and so on. But anyway, they had it all decked out in lush carpeting, brilliantly lit, and there was a band playing, and all the brides wore their bridal gowns, white bridal gowns, pretty much identical, because we were supposed to follow a certain pattern. And the men all wore navy blue suits and maroon ties and white shirts and so on. So then we get into the arena, and Reverend Moon said words. He had us make a vow. He said it in Korean, but we had the English translation, and we were all to say yes to it. So that's the wedding part. Now, I must say, to make it clear, that the wedding part is more or less the public part of the blessing. But the actual key ceremony occurs more in private, and that's the holy wine ceremony. And that occurred during the matching part of the whole deal. Because when I was matched up to that woman that I mentioned, whom I had never met before, I met her that day. And then the next day, we went into the ballroom of the New Yorker Hotel, which is the hotel Moon owns. We were each given a small sip of wine. It's kind of like a communion in the Christian church. And supposedly the holy wine was sanctified by Reverend Moon, and it takes away your original sin so long as you remain faithful to Moon throughout your life. And that is the real heart of the blessing, if you like.
So it's at that point where Jesus' mission is completed with respect to these people who undergo this ceremony.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. Now, you obviously mentioned something of your experience there, and from what I've read about your experience, this marriage didn't actually go all that well.
No, it did not, and could be all kinds of reasons for it, but the main reason is that we were not allowed to actually live together after the wedding. So the wedding happened in, July 1982, but my wife now had to return to the UK for her mission, and I had to return to Los Angeles for my mission.
Cool.
And we were to only communicate by letters thereafter. And during the course of the long wait, because we didn't know how long the wait would be, Reverend Moon himself was going to determine that. But the basic rule of thumb was that we were supposed to be separate for 3 years. And during that 3-year period, we were supposed to each find at least 3 new recruits, our so-called spiritual children. And if we completed those conditions, then we would be allowed to live together thereafter. But during that period of time, that separation time, my wife found that she couldn't stand the intense pressure of Unification Church life, and she quit the Unification Church. That left me in a position in 1984, 2 years after the wedding, where I had to decide, okay, not every church member can say this, but I had formed an emotional attachment to this person. I thought, you know, that I wanted her as my wife.
But I mean, did you get to know her at all? Do you have any opportunity?
Yes, I did, because she expressed her struggles to me in some of her letters. And so I went to visit her in 1981. I came to the UK from America to see her, spent some time with her. Her family was open-minded enough that they would allow me to visit them with her. So I saw her parents, and then I went to meet the people she worked with. She worked in Edinburgh at the time. They were part of a musical band, and I went around with them for a week and a half or something like that. And then I had to return to the United States thereafter. So I did get more acquainted with her then.
But presumably that would be the exception rather than the rule. I would have thought that in most cases there would be very little communication, and basically the wedding would have been a pure fiction. At least that's the impression I'm getting.
Well, you're right. The exception was made because my wife was actually threatening even back then that she would leave the church. And that was considered to be such a serious circumstance that the church would allow me to go to her to try to prop her up and keep her going, sort of idea. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they would not have allowed it, because normally it was considered, you know, you stick to your mission, do what you're supposed to do. Also, quite often in these marriages, it would be between people who don't even speak the same language. Many American male Americans, we call them the brothers, many American brothers were matched to Japanese sisters. So these Japanese women could not really speak the language very much, and they had very limited communication with each other until the day came when they actually got together. And that's when they would finally get to know each other.
Yeah, it seems extraordinary that he should have chosen such a method in order to sort of live out this doctrine, because presumably the idea was that these should have been model marriages that people could look to and say, yes, you know, this is working. But presumably a lot of these marriages just don't work.
Well, the Unification Church would argue otherwise. They would say that they're very successful, and arranged marriages statistically probably do about as well as other marriages anyway. But I know of quite a few horror stories of very bad marriages that occurred because Reverend Moon more or less just, I would say, randomly puts people together. Or he looks at pictures and he says, oh, these two pictures look all right, and he sticks them together, and people end up, being very opposite in their inclinations. And they're supposed to accept that as God's, I don't know, the burden or mission that given by God to them is that they have to put up with this person and figure out how to make it work anyway. So they look on it that way, and so they may go their whole lives doing that.
And I suppose that's because Moon was trying to cope with so much, I guess. If he really was in control of every single marriage, then there's just no way he could do enough research to make sure that people were suitable for each other.
No, he was just doing guesswork, I think, and a few times it works out fine, but a lot of times it doesn't.
Yeah. Okay, could you give us some idea then how you first got into this, right in the first place? What was your background?
So I grew up in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. I was always anxious to be a writer. That was my ambition from the beginning. And I went to university in Calgary for 2 years to study English. And then I took a year off to be a writer, but it didn't work very well. And I realized I need to go back to university because that's where I get the deadlines and so on to produce work. So yeah. I chose the University of British Columbia because they had creative writing, and I went back and I completed 2 more years, and then I got my bachelor's degree in English at that time. It was 1976. So I was at that point where I was probably ready to go off and try to be a serious writer. But at that time, I took a trip to Southern California, to Northern California, and then I was going to go on to the South. And that's when I encountered the Unification Church. The irony is that I was not very religious, and I was not particularly seeking a religious answer to my emotional troubles. I was just traveling, and I met these people in Fisherman's Wharf. My story is a familiar one because many others tell a similar story of meeting the Unification Church in San Francisco. And there's these friendly people who say they're from the Creative Community Project, and they're just so effusive in their warmth that you feel like they're almost irresistible, but they're not really saying exactly what they're about. So maybe you're a little suspicious, but you also feel like it would be rude to just, rebuff them without checking it out. And then they say, why not come to a free dinner? And if you're traveling like I was by yourself with no real strong agenda, you think, oh, okay, why not? So I went to a free dinner at the Unification Church house. And again, I did not know it was the Unification Church. I had not even heard of Reverend Moon at the time. If I had heard of him, I don't know if it would have made a big difference, because I was mostly just affected by their warmth and their friendliness. And then they said, well, why not come up to our farm for a few days? It's real fun and people relaxing. And they showed slides of people lying on the ground in a circle and so on. And it seemed like it might be fun, but I wasn't really inclined. But it just happened that I went back a second time to that house, and then they talked me into it. So I went up to their farm for what I thought would be 3 days. And when 3 days is almost up, they say, oh, you must stay longer. We have such a great program for the weekend. Stay for the weekend. So I stayed for the weekend. And then they say, oh, but you haven't heard it all yet. We've got the really good stuff coming up if you stay for the week. So I stayed for another week. And that's sort of how it went. They just kept persuading me to stay longer, but I still didn't know the whole picture. Even after 3 weeks at that farm, I still didn't know about Reverend Moon, and they still hadn't really revealed the degree to which they were, in fact, a very strong religious organization. They were still sort of fudging it.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned this farm. Is that something that they generally do? I read somewhere that they have these isolated buildings where they take people. Is that normal?
They have done that, but it's not always the way it works, because I know of stories of people who go to, say, their building in central New York City and study for an hour and leave. So it doesn't always work that way. But generally they encourage people because it simply they can have more emotional control over you if they get you away into a isolated setting. So yes, they'll generally encourage people who express some interest and maybe show up for a few evenings at the center in Philadelphia or someplace like that. They say, why not come to our farm in upstate New York and spend a little time? And then people go there. And I know they have one of these in England as well. And that's when they really work on you.
Mm-hmm. So they give you little bits of information. They don't reveal, as you say, that they're a religion necessarily to start with. They don't necessarily even mention about Sun Myung Moon. They're just sort of drip feeding you with this information. How long could this go on for?
Well, okay, again, I have to qualify because my experience in the what was called the Oakland family, the Bay Area, was different from what a lot of other church members experienced. They were very, played their cards very close to their chest, and they were not like the ones in New York or even London, England, where they would be more upfront about some things. In the Oakland Bay Area, they would actually keep the knowledge of who they really were a secret for weeks at a time if they could. But I would say that, even for the other groups that are a little more upfront, they still try to avoid talking about controversial issues as much as possible and try to win you over with friendliness and get you to go to one of their other meetings. And it's all part of a gradual process where they think they can get you to put aside your doubts and your fears and whatever somebody has told you and just say, oh, I like these people, so I'm going to go with them anyway.
Okay, so how did you get further into it? Because obviously you made the decision to become a member. How did that happen?
Well, my book explains it because it's really kind of an emotionally intense thing. You know, I was there in that farm, and one part of me just didn't buy the doctrines they were teaching. They had taught me at least some of the divine principle by this time. I had a lot of trouble with things like I didn't literally believe in a literal Adam and Eve as human beings who walked on Earth at the time, and quite a number of other doubts about their doctrines. But I think they just kept persuading me that if I give it another try and stay a little longer, and they would tell me, don't close your heart. This may be the thing that you've been waiting for. So the longer you hang in, even though you feel doubt, the more inclined you are to suddenly decide to put aside your doubts. Just put them on the shelf, which is not the same as, you know, dismissing them entirely. You're just basically saying, I'm not going to think about this right now, and I'm just going to go with the part that I like, the friendship and all that. I think that's how I got to the point where I just decided I'm going to put all these doubts on the shelf and I'm going to just go with it. And so that happened about, I'd say, 3.5 weeks into my time at the farm. And so then that weekend, they then sent me down to the center in San Francisco to begin my transition to becoming a full-time member of the Unification Church.
And you say that your experience in the church was that you were promoted until you came to this position where you were a leader in training at the seminary. Could you explain what that training was like and what it is you were expecting to gain out of that training?
I'm not sure that I was exactly promoted. I was mostly just moved from mission to mission until finally they decided I was ready for the seminary. My qualification for being at the seminary was that I had my undergraduate degree. They thought that I might be a good prospect. So at the seminary, at that time, because the seminary's changed over the years, but at the time, they were mostly looking for young men and women who they could put out there as good, positive or intelligent face for the organization. And we took a variety of courses in subjects like psychology, theology, church history, Korean language, martial arts. Right. It's an eclectic program, but it was basically considered, at the time it was called a Master of Religious Education program. And the idea was we would educate other members, I guess.
And the whole thing was, from what you say, seems to have been geared towards the mission of the church. Was there any sense that you were being trained towards some kind of ordained ministry in a local congregation? Do they have local congregations in the conventional sense?
They do now, but they didn't then. No, we just thought Moon might give us the title just so that we would be more impressive to other people. But no, we at the time, we're talking 1980 here, it was still very much a case where most of the members were single, and even if they were married in the church, they were still living by themselves. And so the men would live one place, the women in separately, and so on. And we would go out and do church activities, primarily fundraising. We'd go out and sell things, or witnessing. We'd go out and try to recruit more people.
So how long did you say you were in this for? 10 years. Did you spend most of those 10 years going out, as you say, fundraising and witnessing to people? Or was most of that time spent, you know, with pen and paper being instructed?
No, all kinds of things. After the seminary, I kind of ended up on another track. I was the church, when they find a member isn't cooperating the way they like, they kind of sidetrack them, and that's what got happened to me. I went to Los Angeles after the seminary, and I was trying to pursue this. Frankly, I was pursuing a psychological therapy that I thought would be helpful for me, but the church didn't truly approve of it. But at the same time, they weren't going to say, no, you shouldn't do it. So I was interested in Arthur Janov's theory of primal therapy, and I went to Los Angeles to do that. And then in the end, I couldn't complete that therapy, and I did a number of other things with the church. I did assist them with some fundraising and some witnessing, but I didn't do it every day like some members did. And there was even a period of time where I lived with my family back in Canada while I was still a member of the Unification Church. I still believed, but because I was in a situation where I felt I had to go back to Canada, I was tired of working illegally in the U.S., so I went back to Canada so I could work legally and you know. But then I was more isolated from the church. There weren't really any other members around in Calgary, Alberta at the time, and I just continued to correspond with them and maintained my faith that way. And then in 1985, I tried to work with the Unification Church in Toronto, where they did have other members. And I couldn't get along with the church leader, who didn't want like a person like me, who was sort of not completely obedient in every respect. So then in 1986, I said, I'm going to try to work with somebody I know. This was a man I knew from the seminary when I was there, and he was in charge of the Unification Church in Montana. So I went to Montana, and I spent about 7 months there. And then that was the breaking point. I had tried virtually everything I could to maintain my standing in the Unification Church, but they didn't seem to be very interested in me. And meanwhile, my wife that I had hoped to marry had left the church, and so I had to either wait for Reverend Moon to give me another partner, or, you know, I had to decide if I wanted to defy the doctrine and go and look search of someone on my own. And in 1986, I finally concluded that I was tired of the way the church operated. Basically, they would have all these campaigns, and you'd run out on a campaign, and the campaign would not achieve its objectives, and then you'd have to go back and try something else. And I felt like I wasn't getting anything done in my own life. I wasn't building a career or anything. So in 1986, I quit the Unification Church and went back to Canada to live. And that's when I, after a period of, I'd say, 2 years, I decided, okay, I'm going to go back to school again, and I'm going to study the thing I most love. I'm going to study writing. So that's why I ended up with a master's degree in writing.
So would you say that the core of your coming out of the Unification Church was this feeling of rejection by them, that you weren't being completely obedient, so they didn't really approve of that, and so they rejected you? Was that the core of it?
Yeah, that would be about right, yes.
Mm-hmm. And so along with that, did you also have doubts about, well, you said that in the first place you had doubts about the doctrine, but you decided to put those questions on the shelf and just go for it. But did you find that those doubts persisted throughout your time with them?
After a while, those doubts just became calcified. I don't know. It's not that I began to doubt. I began to develop a lot of doubt about the ability of the Unification Church to deliver on what they said they were going to do. See, when I was a very young member of the Unification Church in 1977, they said, by 1981, all of America will be at Reverend Moon's feet and will be following Reverend Moon. So 1981 comes and nothing of the sort is happening. And I just began to realize that most of these campaigns to win over new members weren't getting very far. And the church didn't appear to be able to address its own problems or take seriously like some of the contradictions that I saw. So that's where the doubts came from.
Now, one of the things which you mention, well, this is right at the beginning of your book, you mentioned about mind control. And in what you said, I was reminded of this because you were talking about absolute obedience to the organization. Could you say something about the role of mind control in the organization and what kind of techniques they use?
The mind control is at the beginning, and not everyone would agree that mind control is present. I would say that it was more commonly used in the Bay Area, the Northern California group, than anywhere else in the organization. But it mostly involved what Robert J. Lifton, he writes about brainwashing in his 1961 book, Thought Control, and I forget the full title, but his book describes certain things that you do to create the possibility that a person can just change their mind and change their personality suddenly. One of the things is you get the people to be kept in a space where they have little contradictory information available, where they are in a cult of confession, where they're constantly admitting their own fault and therefore suggestible to, we have the answer. You limit their speech so that they use certain jargon terms all the time, limit their thought. By limiting their speech, you limit their thought. So this is another aspect of it. Altogether, Lifton describes 8 conditions for creating the thought reform or mind control. And I felt that in the Boonville farm where I went in 1976, they basically did all of those things. But there was, just to set aside some of the rumors that go around, there was no protein starvation and there was no drugs used or anything like that. It was just this manipulation and controlling the information you had, controlling your movement so that you felt you had to conform all the time and that sort of thing. That's what how the mind control worked, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. That's very important to bring that distinction because, yes, there is this idea, isn't there, that it's a much more aggressive kind of mind control. But as you say, it can be quite subtle, but nevertheless very, very powerful. And you also say that it doesn't necessarily apply to every group, that there may be one group that operates with this kind of mind control, this sort of subtle mind control system, but another group may not use it at all.
At least they wouldn't use it as much.
Okay, right, yeah. And there are people, I mean, I looked at the Wikipedia article about the Unification Church, and there are people who are writing there on Wikipedia, and of course one doesn't know who's actually writing these articles, so one always has to be skeptical, but nevertheless, who say that mind control is not really something that's recognized by the American Psychiatric Association. So what do you make of that?
I feel that it's very much a reality, and that it can be demonstrated, and that I attend these conferences of the International Cultic Studies Association where they have people arguing about that there are conditions where thought reform or mind control take place. So the people who are saying that it doesn't exist are basically people who just don't want to examine the evidence, and they usually have a vested interest in that because they belong to a group like the Unification Church or Scientology, and it's not in their interest to acknowledge that it even exists. But it is hard to pin down, so that's part of the problem. It has been written about, and there's the Lifton book that I mentioned, and there are others that followed it, which describe thought reform, mind control. And I would especially praise the book by Stephen Hassan called Combating Cult Mind Control, because that book just explains in very good terms exactly how that works.
And you got out of this situation without any therapy, you say. How difficult did you find that, to remove yourself from that situation and also the thoughts that were inside your head? I presume you had accusing thoughts that you should really never have left. How did you deal with all that?
Oh, yes, it's a torment. You don't leave all at once and say, I'm done with them, goodbye. Rather, you leave in steps where you start out thinking to yourself, I really should stay in the church, but I can't handle it anymore. It's too emotionally overwhelming. So I'm going to go. and a lot depends on where you go. I went back to my family in Calgary, but I still felt some attachment to the church, and I still felt like Reverend Moon himself was a good person, and maybe the fault was with his subordinates and not with Moon himself. So you go through a period of time where you try to reason out, why did I have to leave when this is supposedly the answer for everybody? Maybe after a while, you'll read something and you'll have some doubts. But, you know, it took me several years before I was ready to read books by former members of the Unification Church. And the one that set this off was reading Stephen Hassan's Combating Cult Mind Control. And here I was already studying writing at the University of British Columbia. And I finally decided I need to read a book by somebody who is opposed to the church. Even though I myself am no longer a member, I still kind of favor them. So I read this book, and I was startled because I had always thought mind control doesn't exist. And this book convinced me that it did exist and that I had endured mind control. And then from that, I said, okay, then now I have to read all those other books I've always been afraid to read by Barbara Underwood and several other writers who are former church members who then wrote about their experiences. After I read those books, I felt like that I made a real shift. And suddenly it wasn't, oh, I should still be a member, but I just can't handle it. It became, oh, I'm glad I'm out. That was all a dupe, and that was a fraud. And then my anger came after that. So but the title of my book is Heartbreak and Rage. The rage is the part where I realized it was all a fraud, and I became furious with them for manipulating me for so long.
Do you feel that you lost a lot of your life through that?
Yeah, in a sense I did, because that's 10 years of my life where I could have been pursuing a career, doing something more useful. I thought I was saving mankind, and I came to the conclusion that all I had done was glorify Reverend Moon, who didn't deserve such glorification, and all I'd done was enrich him, and he didn't deserve the enrichment either. But you can't say that's an entire loss. Because after all, I learned a lot from that experience. It gave me a lot of material that I now write about, because I've spent quite a few years now writing short stories about people caught up, not necessarily in the Unification Church, but in some kind of cult-like situation. So this has created a lot of material for writing. And of course, the best thing that happened from the Unification Church was that I wrote about my experience in that book, Heartbreak and Rage. And as a result, a woman who also was a former church member wrote to me, and we got set to corresponding, and then I married her, which is a delightful thing. It happened in 2009. I married my wife, Mary Jo Downey, and so in a way, I could not have met Mary Jo Downey if I hadn't been a member of the Unification Church.
Yeah, and I suspect also that your book has helped a lot of people out there who you may not even know about.
Yes, that could be.
Have you had much correspondence from writing that book?
Yes, I get maybe one or two people writing to me every so often. It's available on Amazon and so on, but it's not widely available, but people do notice it. And then there's my website, moonbook.com, which explains about the book a little more fully. I just feel like it was a start, and I'm now working on other writing. And I'm moving in a new direction where I'm kind of moving away from writing strictly about cults and the cultic religion. But it's still always going to be a part of my writing because it was such a tremendous experience.
Sure. Sure. And the last thing that I'd like to ask you really is what advice you would have for people, because there may be people listening who have relatives or friends who are either involved in that organization or who've been approached by members and are finding it interesting. What general advice would you give to people like that?
You're saying they already have people involved in the church?
Well, I'm saying there are various possibilities. There may be friends and relatives who are involved in that organization. There may be situations where families where, say, a child, say a teenager or something, has been approached at college and is finding it interesting. You know, could you just imagine various scenarios, and have you any general advice of how people should really deal with that situation? I mean, one possibility is to go in, you know, like a bull in a china shop, as we say here in the UK, and say, I don't have anything to do with that. But I mean, is that really the best way to go about it?
I think that's not a very effective approach, because what happens is that person will then feel defensive, and they'll say, "But these people are so nice. How could that be?" And it may in fact have the opposite effect from the desired effect. What Stephen Hassan recommends, actually, in a later book that he wrote, was always keep the door of communication open. Don't slam the shut the door and say, "Because you're a Mooney, I'm not going to talk to you again." Anything like that. Instead, say to them, "Our door is always open. We're always here to listen to you." Eventually, they're going to get, just like I got burned out, they're going to get tired of the organization and its contradictions. They're going to get tired of the way some leaders treat the members. And they're going to say, "You know, I don't want to do this anymore. Maybe I'll go back to my cousin or my friend or my aunt or somebody who's willing to listen to me and who never slammed the door shut on me." So that's the main thing, is don't close the door on these people, even if you don't like what they're doing. Wait for them to come out, because most of them will. And then the other thing is, if you have, say, a younger person who's just been approached, just try to talk it over with them and tell them what you know, and point them to resources on the web or books, and say, "You know, this is what people say about that group. Maybe you should think twice about it." But I'd say don't be too argumentative, because that just seems to backfire in my experience.
Great advice. So keep that door open and keep friendly, keep approachable at all times.
That's right. Yep.
I know you've already mentioned about how people can get hold of your book, but I guess the website might have just slipped by. So could you mention the website again, where they can get hold of it?
Oh, yes. It's www.moonbook.com.
Great. And can you think of any other websites that are particularly useful for this kind of thing, resources that you would recommend?
I've mentioned Stephen Hassan a few times. He was very helpful to me in the early stages of my leaving the church. So he has a website called freedomofmind.com, and I recommend that one.
Before the interview started, you actually mentioned a couple of resources on the internet, and I shall put those in the show notes because they're very interesting. I think we've run out of time to discuss those particular things, but they're certainly very interesting. So anybody who's listening to this and interested to look into that further, those links will be there. So may I say, Gordon, thank you ever so much for being with us today. It's been an amazing conversation, actually, looking both at your life but also the teachings and the history of this organization, and thank you ever so much for sharing so much of your own personal experience with us.
All right, thank you, Julian. That was very good.
Thank you ever so much for coming on.
All right, thank you, Julian. Bye now.